Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. Today's guests are actor, comedian, writer Michael Ian Black, whose new book is A Better Man, A Mostly Serious Letter to My Son, and journalists and television hosts Cleo Stiller, the author of Modern Manhood, Conversations About the Complicated World of Being a Good Man Today. They're joining conversation by radio and television presenter Mara Davis. And now join Mara Davis as she introduces Michael Ian Black and Cleo Stiller.
I am so excited to be here doing another one of these interviews on behalf of the National JCC Literary Consortium. And we have a really great night with Michael Ian Black and his new book, A Better Man, Mostly Serious, Letter to My Son, and author Cleo Stiller with her book, Modern Manhood, Conversations About the Complicated World of Being a Good Man Today. So the way it's going to work is we're going to do an interview with each separately, and then in the end, we're all going to come together, and then we're going to answer all of your questions. So let's get to it. We're going to kick off the evening with Michael Ian Black, who is an actor, comedian. He started a show with the show The State on MTV, and he's been on so many TV shows and great movies like Wet Hot American Summer, the Baxter Sextuplets, and he's the author of a lot of books for kids, including the award-winning I'm Bored, I'm Sad, and I'm Worried. That could be a pandemic book now. He's a stand-up comedian who tours regularly. And oh gosh, I'm not going to read all his credits because he's done everything that you already love. Say hello to Michael Ian Black. What's happening?
Hi, Mara. I'm delighted to be here. Hello, Cleo. I know you're just off screen somewhere else, but hello. Hello, everybody watching. And hello to me.
Well, congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
I'm curious, does Pearl Jam know about this book?
I don't think they do. And if they do, they haven't contacted me. I would be thrilled if they did.
So this book came out of an op-ed that you wrote. And it's funny because I interviewed another author in this series, Judy Gold, and her book got developed because of an op-ed. So is an op-ed the new pitch for book deals?
Apparently. I didn't know. I mean, the New York Times asked me to write an op-ed. Nobody had ever asked me to write an op-ed before. I didn't know that I could write an op-ed, but I wrote one. And then a publisher called and said, hey, do you want to write a book about this? And I was like, not really. But I met with them. And then we talked about it and talked about it some more. And I decided, all right, I will try, because I didn't think I could. I really didn't think I could write this book because it's a big subject. And I didn't feel qualified to write a book about guys, even though I happen to be one.
Right. And it's so much with parenting too. I mean, could you have told yourself, like, when you were having, before you had kids, that you'd be writing a book like with parenting advice?
Or like, I lie to myself all the time. I could tell myself a million things that don't turn out to be true. No, I mean, you know, it's funny. As I was writing this book, and I guess there is advice in it, but I never thought of it I never thought of what I was saying as advice, because I really don't feel qualified to give advice to other parents. I'm the father of an older boy he's 19 now, and a younger daughter. She's 17. And I make all the mistakes that every parent makes. Maybe I make an above average amount of mistakes. But you know, I don't want to take any credit for anything good that my kids do, because that will mean I will have to take responsibility for anything bad they do. And I'm not willing to take that responsibility.
You know, the book opens up on such a painful note. I mean, the fact with Sandy Hook, being like in the next town over, I mean, and just reading that was just so gripping and heartbreaking. How do you talk about that with your kids now? Because they were, you know, little at the time. I mean, do you come back to that? I mean,
this is such a... When that elementary school shooting happened, it happened in the town next door, maybe half a dozen miles from my house. I don't know that we have talked about Sandy Hook directly as a family since it happened. Of course, like every time the anniversary rolls around, like we, you know, sort of acknowledge it. I mean, you can't not acknowledge it in the community where I live. But we've talked about a lot of other shootings since. I mean, the another shooting was the immediate catalyst for this book, the shooting in Parkland, in Florida. That's what the op-ed was about. It was about gun violence, and it was about asking the question, why is it always young men and boys who are pulling the trigger? And it was that question that led to this book.
And there's so many references to men in that way. Like there's the one like passage or chapter that I liked was the one on pride and talking about, well, one thing was you talk about Scrabble and I'm a Scrabble nut. So I got a kick out of that because it's true. There's like, you talk about how there's all the Scrabble experts are all dudes. There's like no ladies. And that's so true.
And it's because, the quote in the book, let's see if I can find it.
Wait, you say something like, you know, women have other shit to do.
Right. And that's the case. It's like men obsess about these things. And it can be anything. I mean, you can pick anything. You can pick playing guitar or playing in it. Whatever, barbecuing, whatever it is. You will find men obsessing about it because we derive enormous pride and self-satisfaction out of mastery or attempted mastery in something. And it's not because, I mean, I don't think it's because there's any biological difference on this point between men and women. It's because we're brought up as men to win. Like that is so much a part of what masculinity is about for guys. It's about kind of winning and doing everything in your power to outcompete the next dude. And it is dudes really that we feel like we're competing with. So you can derive like your entire self-worth from playing Scrabble. I mean, I spend an inordinate amount of time studying and learning and playing poker. Am I a good poker player? Not particularly. But I keep lying to myself because I'm capable of that I'm better than I am and trying to, you know, trying to vanquish whatever foes I find when I sit down to play poker.
So that's really funny, you know, and I think maybe that's why people, I don't know if you've watched that show, The Queen's Gambit.
I've seen every episode.
Okay, so like I'm not done with it yet, but like how everybody's just, it's so shocking that there's like a woman that plays chess because it's such a, it's exactly what you just said, right?
Yeah. There's an obsessiveness over competition that guys have that women don't have as much. All the top, you can pick any event, any competition in which there should be no difference between men and women, Scrabble, poker, chess, backgammon, Monopoly. I mentioned it in the book, there's competitive Monopoly. And the champions of all these things are always men. And it's because women have to do, like you said.
By the way, that was an amazing nugget to learn that there's competitive Monopoly.
High stakes competitive Monopoly.
I think that I think it was Rainn Wilson has a new show on Netflix where it's all like weird competitive sports.
Oh, really?
Yes. Like dog dancing and like all kinds of weird things and like competitive Monopoly. Like who's doing that? But people are. We've learned from your book.
When we've learned that it's guys who are doing it. It's guys.
All right. So you talk about how your son like really hasn't read the book or he's read parts of the book. So what's it been his reaction? And, you know, as the book's been out for a while, what's the feedback you've gotten from him?
From him? Almost none.
Yeah.
Almost none.
None.
In acknowledgement that it exists. Yes. In acknowledgement that he has read some of it, but nothing along the lines of great job, Dad. I'm really glad you wrote this book. I'm really glad you poured out your heart in this letter to me, your son. None of that.
Because you said he's...
I'm assuming it will become cherished when I'm dead. Once I'm dead, I'm assuming it will be a cherished keepsake for him. But until then, no.
Can you talk a little bit about like growing, what you feel like it was like for him growing up with his dad being a stand-up comedian?
Well, first of all, like, I'm not funny around the house. Really at all. Like, I'm not particular. I don't make a lot of jokes. I don't really talk about comedy or my career that much. It was important to me that whatever celebrity, and it's minor celebrity, whatever minor celebrity I have, that that gets left at the door of my house. It was important to me that my kids think of me only as dad and really nothing else. Like, I never show them anything that I'm in. I barely talk about things that I'm in. So hopefully it, you know, hopefully for them, the experience was no different than somebody whose, you know, dad works at the bank. Like, I hope it was the same. On the flip side of that, they're not impressed with me at all.
But they could look you up now. I mean,
they can Google me, and I'm sure they have.
Yeah.
But I've tried to play down any of that stuff as much as I possibly can. Every now and again, there's a perk that comes with the job. Like when there was still Broadway, which seems like a long time ago now. Occasionally I would get invited to an opening and I would take one or the other to a Broadway opening, something like that. But those occasions are pretty far and few between.
So how was college for him this
short,
year?
Abbreviated. He went, he was there his first two semesters or two quarters. They are in a quarterly system. And then at spring break, he came back and he's been home since.
Wow. So have you gotten closer with your son? I know like you haven't talked about the book, but like I have a teenage son too. And like the pandemic's really sucked. Like there's no question to all the reasons why, but there are some silver linings. And especially when you have a teenager, do you find that you've had, feel that you, you know, maybe you've had some, you know, like retrospective moments with him in this time?
Well, I feel like we were pretty close before, you know, and he wasn't gone long enough for us to, for any distance to really occur between us. So, you know, no, I don't think we've become any closer, but we've always been pretty close.
Cool.
So, and it's been great. I mean, great is relative. I mean, it's been great having him.
Great.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm glad he's here, even though I'm sad for him that he's here. Cause you know, he doesn't want to be home. He wants to be, you know, in college, doing college stuff. And I don't blame him, but his mom and I, you know, we're greedy for our kids and, you know, for us, there is a silver lining that he's around.
Yeah, for sure. I feel that. Do you still love the 80s?
I don't know that I ever loved the 80s particularly, but I did like getting a paycheck for saying that I love the 80s.
What?
If you want to write me a check, I'll say it right now. I love the 80s. I love the 80s.
I mean, those shows were so great. I mean, I think we learned so many. I mean, did you think that when you sat down to do those interviews that do you realize they'd be played over and over and over and over?
No. They just asked me to do it. And I was like, I'm sure. Why not? And so, yeah, it turned into a whole thing, which was great. I mean, it was that show more than anything is responsible for my stand-up career. Like I'd been doing comedy and television and stuff before that, but I hadn't been doing stand-up comedy in the way that you think about stand-up comedy. And it was those shows that kind of gave me the opportunity to start doing that more regularly. And it was a form that I'd always admired a lot, but always felt too intimidated to try in a serious way.
What kind of dog do you have?
Animals. I have two. I have a big white lab and a tiny little, we call them dog, just a little dog. But you know, it was like doing stand-up, I think, was the first time that I really decided very consciously to move towards my fear, to move towards doing something creative that I was actually afraid of. And it was that experience ultimately that informed my decision to write this book, because I was very afraid to write this book. But it was the experience of moving towards fear in stand-up and in other things in my life that ultimately kind of persuaded me that I could give it a shot.
Why was there fear? You have written a lot of other books. I mean, this was not like, what, can you talk to me a little bit about what was behind that fear?
Sure. It was, I knew that I wanted to write a synthesis, a very personal kind of synthesis about masculinity, my understanding of masculinity. And to do that felt incredibly daunting because it involved taking a very personal look at it and then also zooming out and taking a very kind of macro look at it. For me to do it the way I felt like I wanted to do it would require me to be smarter than I felt like I was. And so it required a lot of deep thinking and research and trying to distill complicated ideas into ways that I could understand them and that I could pass on to my son. And I knew it was going to be a challenge, an enormous challenge. And I felt like there are so many ways to get this wrong. And it's already a subject that people have kind of sharp feelings about. And if I get it wrong, it's, you know, it's going to be painful for me. And I didn't want to get it wrong. And I'm willing to have people disagree with me, of course. And people are welcome to disagree with the things that I've arrived at. But what I feel like I got right, at the very least, was articulating my own understanding of what masculinity is and where I feel like it needs to go.
Well, I think you have some really powerful observations, especially in the sense where it's like, you know, it's kind of the way your things are trained early on, the way you see things in pop culture, the way you're raised, the way things are in sports. It's kind of like you're refocusing, you know, you're like changing the game a little bit. So you want people's minds to be open or to challenge you potentially.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. I want to challenge people and I want to be challenged. I mean, I'm interested in the conversation. I'm definitely not interested in standing on a soapbox and saying, listen to me. I'm saying this is my contribution to this topic. And I'm hopefully persuadable, as I hope that this audience, you know, this reading audience is persuadable. It's a nuanced subject. And I think so often we get caught in a kind of binary, just as we caught up in a binary between like what's feminine, what's masculine. We get caught in a kind of cultural binary about whether masculinity itself is good or bad or needs to be reinvented or is fine the way it is. And it ends up making people, I think, really defensive on both sides of that subject. And I'm saying it's not an either or proposition. It's a both proposition. Like we can sort of start at a place that we're all familiar with and expand it and kind of upgrade the way we think about boys and men in a way that I think is inclusive of everybody and will hopefully and have the result of making us guys happier. And happiness isn't a conversation that often comes up in when we talk about masculinity. And I think it's a neglected topic when we talk about masculinity. Guys aren't often asked what makes you happy because our happiness isn't prioritized over our utility and our ability to go out into the world and do things and hunt things and put down seven-letter Scrabble words. Like, it's not, they're not the same thing. Our utility and our happiness are different. And we've emphasized male utility for so long. I'd like to rebalance it a little bit and talk about what makes us happy.
You're listening to actor, comedian, and writer Michael Ian Black, whose new book is A Better Man, A Mostly Serious Letter to My Son, and journalist and television host Cleo Stiller, the author of Modern Manhood, Conversations About the Complicated World of Being a Good Man Today. They're joined in conversation by Mara Davis on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, I definitely want to get back to that, and I really want to get that 50-point Scrabble. Oh, yeah.
You'll get the bonus.
5-0. But we're going to get to our next guest, and we're going to come back to you in just a minute because there's a lot to unpack with you, Michael Ian Black. But Cleo is here, and her book is called Modern Manhood. Cleo is an Emmy Award nominated, Peabody Award nominated, and Gracie Award winning reporter, and a relationship non-expert, self-identified. She's obsessed with exploring stories about health and gender and sex and all of that. Her acclaimed television show, Sex Right Now, gets into deeply personal and political stories. She's been featured in the New York Times, Self, Variety, Bustle, Essence, Life Hacker, and so much more. Please welcome Cleo Stiller. Hi, Cleo.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, gosh. Great to talk to you. I know you and Michael Ian Black have a lot to get to, so let's just talk about your amazing book, which made me laugh. It made me think a lot. I want to pivot off something that Michael was just saying about men and, you know, how we're raising our men. And a big takeaway that I got when I was reading your book, you say that you really started when in the Me Too era, how can I be a good guy? Do you think that's changing a little bit because stronger women are raising more confident men who are more in touch with things than they did maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago?
I can say that I've heard from a lot of parents. So we have a whole chapter in the book dedicated to parenting. And I heard from first-time parents, younger parents, that there was a real desire to think critically about how they were raising their sons and their daughters, for that matter, mm-hmm. But really thinking critically about how their fathers had impacted their idea of what a good man does. And for example, actually, I was recently in a conversation saying that a lot of the lessons that adult men can glean from the book Modern Manhood actually would take us back to kindergarten, because that's where we start separating the genders in ways that impacts our lives for the rest of our lives and mm-hmm. compounds. I think overall we are seeing a massive shift. We know that younger generations are less attached to a gender binary than prior generations. I know, for example, that we are teaching, sometimes in schools, we're teaching little boys and little girls the concept of empathy, which is kind of a new thing to be taught in school, but the importance of teaching empathy early for both boys and girls is that it's very simply a lesson that it's important to care about how your behavior impacts others. Mm-hmm. And this is not something that we've previously focused on. So do I think parenting is shifting? Certainly, that's what the research shows. But perhaps not enough. and also, there is still quite a bit of confusion in the, you know, parent-child dynamic of, am I still supposed to teach my son chivalry? Does that still exist?
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, I can tell you a little bit more about what I've learned about that, but that's where we're at.
So let's go back to how the book started as far as, like, you know, Aziz Ansari made a lot of news because somebody wrote that, you know, they went on a date with him and it sort of went south and it just provided this gray area. I'm not sure if everybody's real familiar with it, but if you've read the book, you talk about it. And I remember reading it. I remember reading about the actor Aziz Ansari and how he went on a date, and I guess the woman felt very pressured to closed the deal and made that very public. Was that a good thing for her to do? I mean, I that's a lot, right?
Well, I will say, so the two sentence summary on that situation for folks who don't know is that Aziz Ansari is an actor and a comedian and very, very beloved for his kind of good guy persona. He had a show called Masters of None in which he played a very self-effacing, lovable guy just out there dating. He also co-authored a book called Modern Romance, so which I had cited as a reporter many times. So when Me Too first hit the mainstream under the guise of the Harvey Weinstein scandal, that was one thing. And many men and women could point to that and say, okay, abusing power like that, abusing people like that is wrong. However, after that, when the Aziz Ansari situation hit the mainstream, that's when the gray areas started to open up, which is actually really what my book deals with. So Aziz Ansari went on a date with a woman. First date, they went back to his place, and she said, just so we're clear, I'm not really interested in getting physical. He said, yeah, no problem. We'll watch a movie. They were at his place, started a movie. He made a move. She said no. He said, oh, yeah, all good. Waited, made another move. She said, listen, should I go? He said, no, it's fine. Made another move. She relented and then left later that night, crying in an Uber, according to her. And he texted her to say, listen, I had a great time. And she wrote back, I think you need to know that I really, you hurt me here. And I, you need to know this so you don't do it again. Now, whether or not the way the story was handled by the media, if that was good or that was bad, I'm really not very interested in. What we can really glean from the Aziz Ansari situation that is so important is that that situation ended up being a sort of Rorschach test for folks. How you responded to Aziz Ansari and whether that deserved to be wrapped in the conversation of Me Too kind of reflected how you felt about the movement in general. And so some people, and this did not fall along gender lines, by the way. It wasn't that all women were sided with the woman and men with men. It did not work like that. Some men I spoke to said, no, what he did was wrong. I have a mother who told me a story that happened to her similar to that. I feel for her and all women in that situation. That's not right. And I heard from plenty of women that were like, that is every day I had in high school, college, and post-college. So if that is a Me Too situation, then I guess all of it is Me Too, right? And what I argue in the book is that just because it's common does not mean that we can't and shouldn't do better. People should not be leaving in Ubers crying. And so, yes, we can use Aziz Ansari as the jumping off point, but regardless of what generation you're in, I know that you someone, right, has a personal reaction to a story like that. And I want to open up the conversation to share so less people are leaving in Ubers crying.
And that's great. I think it's so important to have these conversations, which leads me to when you talk about Brett Kavanaugh. And there's the whole boys will be boys narrative around that. And that still is such a polarizing thing from, just like you say, from men and from women. So how can we ever evolve from this?
So this again is really, I feel it's such a hot button issue for everyone. And I'm sure when a name like Brett Kavanaugh comes up, I mean, I can't see folks' faces, but I'm sure people are having reactions regardless of what you thought. We all have a strong reaction. And again, this feeling that that's how it always goes down, or that happened a long time ago, or I was young when that happened and I didn't know better. That's not okay. Okay. What has happened in the past has happened in the past. Absolutely. But we can 100% do better. And I'll tell you a really quick story of a guy who I interviewed for the book. He was also went to Yale undergrad and contacted me when he heard that I was writing this book because Brett Kavanaugh in particular had meant something to him. So this young man is now in his mid-30s. He lives in LA. And when he was watching the Brett Kavanaugh hearing, a lot of his female colleagues were having such strong reactions during this time that it really made him reflect on his own time at Yale. And he told me that at the time, he was the first of his family to go to college. He'd gone quite young. He was a young man of color. He was first generation in college. He felt very isolated there and very on his own. And so he, very common behavior for undergrads, he drank to mask his depression. There was a woman that he would see only when he was extremely drunk. And he is 99.8% sure that nothing ever really bad happened. But he, there's a 0.2% in his mind that he isn't sure of because of how blackout drunk he would get. Again, a very relatable circumstance for undergrads. So he had told me that this, you know, his time in undergrad was for him long forgotten until he saw how everyone, how the women in his office were reacting to Brett Kavanaugh, and he remembered this woman. And he thought, I can't really judge what I'm watching right now unless I take ownership for my past. And so he said he actually contacted the woman. They were friends on Facebook. And he said to her, listen, I don't know if you even remember me or if this is going to just come completely out of left field, but I need you to know that I'm watching what's happening right now. And I'm realizing that if I ever treated you or made you feel that you were less than, I am so sorry.
Wow. And what was her reaction?
Now, I didn't talk to her, but she did. He told me that she said she had completely not ever expected to hear from him, but that he was the only person that could have made that situation right for her, and that him reaching out to her meant the world.
I believe it. That is, that's a really powerful story because I think as women, a lot of us have been there. And that's why it just, you know, but there were a lot of women who felt that he was wronged in a sense too.
Yes. And that's, so what we talk about in the book is that when you start stripping away, you know, Brett Kavanaugh gets very divisive. When you start stripping away your past history, which makes us all really defensive. If we just look at the simple facts, which is how historically we got here and cultural influences, how we raise girls, how we raise boys, it's actually not surprising at all that we wind up in this situation over and over again, right? And this gets revealed in the book in really interesting and illuminative ways. But for example, we raise men with the hero's journey, which is that a good man at all costs perseveres, not just in dating, but in the boardroom, on the football field. Never take no for an answer. Don't, you get knocked down, get back up again. That's what a good man does. So a good man who gets that message over and over again, by the time he gets into the dating world or anywhere else, that's what a lot of men really focus on. And meanwhile, we put women in this impossible position of don't give it away too quickly. Don't say what you want. And yet if you do, if you don't do anything, then you're a prude. So women have it, you get it coming and going. And then you have men on their hero's journey and never the two should meet because, I mean, God forbid you ever articulate with a partner what you want in an intimate setting. So once you kind of, right, I'm sure everyone here is like, yes, okay, right. Like, oh, that's never going to go well. We're lucky it goes well as often as it does. But these are the kinds of lessons that we reveal in the book to make it less personal and more really empowering. Okay, it's a really confusing time. It's a really frustrating and scary time. But there are real ways that we can unpack this and uplevel our behavior.
Well, we were talking earlier offline about these kind of gender roles in our pandemic world right now, as far as like, you know, it can go, it's just how, look, let's bring up Jeffrey Toobin for a minute. I mean, so, which is not written about in your book, but maybe that's your next book. But I think, you know, for those who don't know, there was a Zoom meeting and his camera was off and he was the master of his own domain. And some people saw that. And that felt like, as a woman, I felt like, oh my gosh, it wasn't just the act. It was like, can't you just not now?
Jeffrey Toobin, I love The Nine. It's one of my favorite books of nonfiction. So don't hold your favorites too close. It's that kind of time for a lot of us.
Do you feel like that incident forces a reappraisal for you of his work?
No, I still love The Nine. I just wish that had not happened.
Well, I think everybody wishes that.
We all wish that everybody.
Most especially Jeffrey Toobin.
Oh, yeah, sure. We can all agree on that. One of the few things we could all agree on. Yeah.
But it's, you know, that's a tough thing. I mean, and you write about this, about like, you know, can you still like Louis C.K.? Can you still like, you know, it's a slippery, it's hard.
Yeah. It's actually one of the questions I was asked the most. And I do want to tell folks that the way that the book came out, Modern Manhood, was interesting because I was hosting my television show for Univision in 2017 when the Me Too movement happened. And a lot of men who watched my show started writing into me, are you going to do a season on this? Because I have so much to say about what's happening right now, but I'm kind of afraid to say anything because I don't want to get in trouble. And then they would ask me a question. And it was a question that, had they asked me 2 years prior, would have seemed really basic. However, given how this movement has had these massive ripple effects, I really didn't know the answer. And there was also this belief, right, that Me Too was only being paid attention to by women. And I knew that that was not true because the DMs and questions from men in my inbox were just piling up for 2 years. So this book deals exclusively with the questions I was asked over and over again. And one of them is, can I still binge on my problematic faves? So on Twitter, you know, I think Michael and I both like to dwell there a little bit too much. People were up in arms, and it was women saying, men, are you okay? But I will say that a ton of men just turned around and they were like, I would never, I have never, I do not understand this at all. But I'm glad that you brought that up because we do have an entire chapter on work in the book. And there has been a question, you know, actually I get this all the time now that when I'm doing interviews, okay, Cleo, but in COVID, with so many of us working remotely, all the Me Too tensions in the workplace kind of disappeared because no one is with each other anymore. And a resounding answer is absolutely not. And I didn't need Jeffrey Toobin to tell you that. That's a great example.
Yeah, I mean, that is that is tough, you know, and it's tough, especially when you talk about, especially at work. I mean, obviously this isn't a Jeffrey Toobin thing. This is just like an at work thing after the Me Too, you know, so I heard from so many men, as did you, like, how do you flirt at work? What's right? What's wrong? I mean, like, I met my husband at work, you know, how would that be different? Like after this, like, earth shattering era we've been in, what's right and what's wrong?
Right. So when it came to work, that was perhaps the single most concentrated area of tension for the men I interviewed. I think because the stakes are so high at work, your livelihood is involved. The men I spoke to felt like they are walking on eggshells. And a lot of the sentiment was, in every other way do I support what I'm hearing, but when it comes to work, I just feel there's a huge fear of being falsely accused, a huge fear of just say one thing and you lose your job. And so the question of office romance, I will say that was like, when you were just worried about even like holding the door for someone, if that's going to get you in trouble, office romance like kind of took a deprioritization. But that was the third most asked question I got. Like, can I even date a coworker?
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guests are actor, comedian, writer Michael Ian Black, whose new book is A Better Man, A Mostly Serious Letter to My Son, and journalist and television host Cleo Stiller, the author of Modern Manhood, Conversations About the Complicated World of Being a Good Man Today. They're joined in conversation by Mara Davis. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So I pulled some stats for you. 65% of respondents to a recent LinkedIn survey have said they have had an office romance. So 65%. And right. 50% have had more than two. Yeah. I think women are more comfortable asking men out in general. In the work setting specifically, I take a really hard line on this, which is not very fun, but I tell everyone, because I do Modern Manhood corporate workshops now, when it comes to work, given that yes, 65% of us have had office romances, and many of them lead to wonderful marriages, I still advise that your love will not develop in a vacuum. It will happen during this time, during which people are on the highest of alert. And so I highly caution against inter-office romances. And the only time that I think it is okay right now is if the two people are at the same level of seniority.
Okay.
Even if you work in different departments, if one is more senior than the other, no.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I want to bring Michael back into the conversation while we're speaking of a love fest. this is a love fest between you two. I could already see on Twitter how excited you guys are to be together. You've done this a couple of times together, correct?
One before.
One. Oh, just one.
Yeah.
So you've read each other's books, obviously. So Michael, what's your biggest takeaway from Cleo's book?
The concision and precision that she really like analyzes this stuff. It's so data driven in a way that I can't be. That you know she's taking, I think, a difficult subject and creating structure around the nuance, which I think is really helpful. And I enjoy it so much because it's something that my book isn't doing. So I feel like they're really good compliments.
And what about you, Cleo? What was your biggest takeaway from Michael's book?
I felt the same way. I felt that our books are just so beautifully aligned because I approach this topic as a reporter. Of course, I'm a human also, and a woman, but I am first and foremost a reporter. And so this book was my book behind me is, you know, not what one woman thinks men should be doing. It was a collection of stories and opinions from nearly 100 men from the ages of 18 to 62, from rural North Carolina to South Central LA, And if anything, I think people asked me, they really wanted me to say what I thought more. And that wasn't my intention with this book. And I loved Michael's because also, I have to just publicly embarrass you now. Everyone that now knows that I'm doing events with Michael has also come out of the woodwork to say what a huge crush they have had on him for so many years. And it's so important for some, again, not to, sorry to embarrass you, but for men with whom what they say and think has power and sway, for people to see Michael open up and be vulnerable about how he was raised, his family, his background, a very specific childhood, and come out and really take a stance on masculinity and why we have to discuss it, that is so critical. Like, I can surface all the stories and all the facts, but to have a face and a vulnerability to this conversation, you know, Thank you.
Look, I'm doing it to get the ladies. You know what it's about.
There's some of them are also on this call too, by the way. So that was for you guys.
If you want to name names, that's fine. But yeah. You know, this guy's off the market.
Yeah. What's your reaction to that? I mean, that's got to make you feel great. I mean, that you know, your book and you, that's not something that we're used to hearing as a man opening up is just provoking such a reaction from women.
I'm trying not to be self-deprecating because it's very difficult for me to hear that anybody could possibly have a crush on me. What I think it points to, hopefully, is that revealing ourselves and showing who we are beneath the mask of masculinity isn't going to make you less desirable as a guy. You know, hopefully the opposite is true. When we reveal ourselves, when we really reveal ourselves and connect with somebody, I think what that does is create a deeper human connection. And ultimately, that's what we're looking for. Whether that ends up being a romantic connection or not is almost irrelevant. What I think is relevant is that trust that you're able to put in somebody else and receive from somebody else, and that common understanding that we're all essentially experiencing the same things. They have different circumstances around them, but fundamentally, we're all experiencing the same kind of base human emotions. And it's important, I think, for guys to recognize that, whatever fears we have, whatever vulnerabilities we might be experiencing, it doesn't make us any less of a man to have those feelings, and because every man has them. Acknowledging them, I think, can be really powerful.
I think so too. And I think, to Cleo's point, it does kind of make you sexy in a little way. Tap into that. I think I do. I think it's, you know, there's just, it's, you know, it's something like a guy who's like really smart or funny, or like, it just, it does add another level. I'm not trying to creep you out. I'm just trying to jump off of Cleo's thing. Why don't we get to some questions? I have one for Cleo, and that comes from Lindsay Benton. And how do you see Me Too, Black Lives Matter aligning moving forward, if at all?
Yeah, that's a really great question. People have asked me if I feel like BLM and the center stage that is taking, rightfully so, in our country right now, is taking the wind out of work being done around Me Too. And I think it's a sad testament to where we are that we could not possibly attack both at once. I think we can, we should, and hopefully we are. Lessons that I can offer folks about BLM and finding your role in justice and equality in our society is that for me too, what I heard from men, when I observed from men that I spoke to, is that there's such a frustration with how much discomfort they're feeling right now. So at first, you know, in 2017, there was, again, I mentioned like this, you could point to Harvey Weinstein and say, yeah, get this guy out of power and get anyone like that out of power that abuses it in that kind of way. And then at a certain point when everything started to shift and there were more implications, the gray areas, the nuances, where people were personally, how they were showing up was being called into question. Then this frustration set in, a rejection of any progress, right? And also just this kind of like throw up your hands and say like, okay, enough complaining, just tell me what to do. So unfortunately, it's not that easy, right? The issues that we have surrounding Me Too, as well as racism and the Black Lives Matter movement in this country, are not going to be changed overnight. And what I offer to men in my book and what I offer to folks participating in justice in this country is that you have to strap in for years of discomfort. And you have to get really clear on why you're doing this. Because a good person does not want to see future generations treated unfairly as they have been. And we have this opportunity now. We're sort of at this, you know, crux, right? Where people who have been previously oblivious, both with Me Too and BLM, are now aware. They're sitting at the table. They're listening. And so this is not going to be a quick fix on either one of these fronts, but it is necessary and critical so that our future generations are not having these conversations. They are not leaving in Ubers crying. They are not being targeted by the police, right? And so strap in for discomfort. Know that you are going to mess up. You are. And when you do mess up and people will make you feel badly about it, I can promise you, try your best not to make that be the time that you just pull out because now you're not interested anymore. Stay with this discomfort. Do the work. Because again, remember that you are committed to more than yourself. You are impacting future generations. And the time, the opportunity we have right now is incredible.
Okay. Strap in for discomfort.
Yeah.
Woof. Okay, Judy Keller wants to know, she said, and I guess, Michael, you can take this. Don't you believe things have evolved and people have and views have evolved, so men's behaviors have changed now that they understand the ramifications? Why don't you believe in a sincere apology is acceptable? I guess that could be for both of you.
Well, I don't know that anybody's saying that a sincere apology isn't acceptable. And it depends on who's giving the apology and who's receiving the apology. These aren't black or white issues. Cleo's example of the guy that she talked to reaching out to his college hookup is a good example of somebody seeking clarification and asking for forgiveness if it was warranted, and somebody else receiving that and accepting the message, and both parties walking away, I think, feeling pretty good about the interaction. Do I think men's behavior has changed? I think the question is maybe, I think it's framed maybe, I would change the framing of it. Cleo was just talking about how we're at an inflection point where this awareness is growing, awareness that I think a lot of guys, in the case of, you know, this issue, haven't had. And so we're being made aware of behavior that is hurting people. And Some people, I'm sure, some men, I'm sure, are changing their behavior. Some men, as Cleo said, are backing away from it because either they're defensive or they're just afraid. It's an ongoing process. Yeah, I think men's behavior probably is changing. It's going to have to keep changing. And it's, in my opinion, this is not a five-year journey. This is a generational journey. This is work that will be unfolding over generations, plural. And that's okay. That's totally fine. The same way that women's roles in the culture have been evolving for the last however many years. Let's say the modern feminist movement, let's say 60 years. That's been generations of work. And it's only now that we're getting to the point where a Me Too movement is even possible. It's not like these problems just appeared overnight. The work is ongoing for both for men and women, and will continue to. And, you know, I think that discomfort is okay. And our culture, I think, is intolerant of discomfort. It's hard to be in a place where there are no easy answers, there's no quick fixes, where you might give offense, where you might fall short. It's hard to live in that discomfort. You want to be right. But, you know, I don't think it's as clear cut as that. Cleo, do you want to take another stab at it?
No, I feel like you did a great job.
Thanks.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you have to be, in order to fix things, you have to be uncomfortable. And you have to face it. That's been a big part of so many problems is that there's been the we don't talk about this.
I would take it further though, Mara, and I would say the goal isn't even to fix it because that implies a kind of end date. The car is going to come out of the shop and it's going to run perfectly. It's never going to run perfectly. And I don't even think that's an impossible goal. In my estimation, what we're trying to do, and that's why I called my book this, we're just trying to get better, you know, step by step by step.
Totally agree. I think you're absolutely right because everybody's version of right and wrong is different.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I hope that can maybe change. And I hope that you two can do a show together because I think you'd be terrific. And I think it's really great to explore these topics and not be quiet about them because like, I think it's true. It's what you said. We're not going to fix it. We're just going to evolve from it. Both of these books are available, Modern Manhood, Better Man. Thanks you guys, everybody buy the books and thanks for enlightening us tonight. This has been great. And we will talk to you next time.
Thank you, Mara. Thank you, Cleo. Bye. Thank you, JCC.
All so much. Goodbye.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were actor, comedian, writer Michael Ian Black, whose new book is A Better Man, A Mostly Serious Letter to My Son, and journalist and television host Cleo Stiller, the author of Modern Manhood, Conversations About the Complicated World of Being a Good Man Today. They were joined in conversation by Mara Davis. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pemmenswan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.